Accession number 18662, Reel 3.
Admiral Garrett's Reel 3.
Joint Intelligence Bureau was responsible for economic and industrial information about the countries in the area, and in the event that one required geographical data, transport, roads and the like, that was part of their assignment. And my wife found herself a job in that organisation, so that we had a happy business relationship as well as a domestic one.
So it sounds as though little of your work was really concerned with the Malayan emergency.
There were a number of groups that were concerned. I was concerned with two aspects of the area directly. One was the extent to which naval support could be given to operations connected with the emergency, that is, bombardments of likely terrorist areas, and patrols to prevent infiltration. And perhaps not so curiously, but more traditionally, anti-piracy patrols. That's particularly applied to the northeast of Borneo. There's a port called Tawau, T-A-W-A-U, and I went on a visit to Borneo, where my great-uncle, Edward Gerrits, and his son-in-law, Aylmer Pearson, had both been governors in their day. And I went and visited Sandakan and Jesselton and Tawau, and found that they were suffering there from a loss of good order at sea, one might say, because there was smuggling and there was piracy. And I'm not sure what if it's the correct terminology, but it seemed to me buccaneering would be a good one. So the people came across and actually went ashore and beat up villagers and stole their belongings. And these people came from the Philippines or some other parts of Indonesia. And so when I went back to Singapore, I raised this matter at the next staff meeting, and it was decided to send a ship on patrol in that area. And to my delight, when I went back to the Singapore in 1965, the ship was still on patrol, not the same one, but the patrol was still maintained, and in fact Tawau figures quite largely in reports about the period which we call confrontation with Indonesia, because it was a point of direct contact with the Indonesians. The other thing which relates to the Bertha Hertog, I said security. Well, security has so many different aspects. Internal security is a matter of maintaining good order and so on in the streets. And then there's personal security, that is, that people are not selling secrets to your likely antagonists. And finally, there's the custody of documents so that they're not carelessly lost or stolen. And so those were parts of my task in the immediate Singapore area rather than elsewhere. But it gave me an introduction to the problem of vetting, because I think it's worth mentioning that a lot of politicians are under the impression that vetting is like some form of entry into a monastic order, that you shed all your vices and you then become a pure and holy individual. Whereas all the vetting does is to say that you haven't been caught hitherto. To this day you hear, had he been vetted? Well, that is, although there is positive and negative vetting, in general, positive vetting is almost as negative vetting.
But as far as the Malayan emergency was concerned, did the Navy make much of a contribution to its suppression?
We had regular patrols on both coasts, and also, as I say, there were forces available for bombardment. But by comparison with the number of troops that were involved, Commonwealth troops, remember, not just UK, the naval contribution obviously was modest. Because the external threat was more likely to come over the border from Thailand than by sea, but it's not impossible.
So you were in Singapore, do I understand, from 50 to 52?
Correct.
And we're still trying to bridge this gap between
right.
Up to 56.
We then went home, and I had a period doing courses in England in 53, including the Joint Services Staff College. And the Senior Officers Technical Course at Greenwich. And I was then promoted to Commander. And immediately the promotion had been announced, I was informed by William O'Brien, subsequently Admiral Sir William. He telephoned and said, "You're going to South Africa, how does that suit?" And I called him Sir, and he said, "You don't have to call me Sir anymore because you're a commander." And that was the way I got the news that I'd been promoted. And we went to South Africa, where I was a fleet operations officer to the Commander-in-Chief and junior naval liaison officer to the High Commissioner for South Africa, for the UK in South Africa. Now, the High Commissioner had two hats. One was as High Commissioner for the UK in South Africa, and the other was as High Commissioner for the territories, the UK territories in the Union, that is, at that time, Bechuanaland, Basutoland, and Swaziland. And they were under the protection of the UK Crown. But my association with the High Commissioner was therefore with his UK hat rather than his Colonial Office hat. And it didn't involve me in any very onerous duties, but obviously there were some matters of common interest, particularly our rapport with the South African Armed Forces.
And the years you're talking about there?
54 to 56. And that gets us back to UK, and that hardly had time to join my new assignment in the Home Fleet Training Squadron, then the Suez Crisis occurred.
Could you tell me about your role in the Suez incident?
Yes. I was nominated as Naval Force Logistics Officer. The force was designated as Task Force 345. It was the Naval Force Commander was initially Vice Admiral Blank Richmond, second in command of the Mediterranean Fleet, and he was to be relieved by Vice Admiral Robin Durnford Slater, to whom I made reference before. So the initial planning was under the aegis of Admiral Richmond, whose chief of staff was Captain Charles Mills, and the Army Force Commander was Lieutenant General Sir Hugh Stockwell, whose chief of staff was Brigadier Kenneth Darling. and the Air Force commander was Air Marshal Sir Dennis Boyd, whose chief of staff was, or perhaps he was described in those days as senior air staff officer, was Air Commodore Thomas Prickett. And the overall commander of the operation was vested in General Sir Charles Keatley, who was commanding in a headquarters in Cyprus. The Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean at the time was Admiral Sir Guy Grantham, who had been Chief of Staff to Admiral Willis at the time of the Corfu incident, incidentally. We carried out our initial planning in offices which had been opened up for the purpose under Whitehall. One hears of references to these underground complexes in the context of the war room, which Churchill so often referred to, and which are now one of the sites of London, as I understand. And it wasn't very long before we were joined in our planning by the French contingent, and I must say these underground offices were not very well suited to the ventilation of Gaulois cigarettes early in the morning, and we worked very long hours, and the biggest problem, of course, was not the complexity of operations we might be required to carry out, but the fact that political direction was inconsistent. And therefore one had changes dictated by variations in political thought. And obviously the military arm must be responsive to political direction, but at the same time it has to be understood by politicians how very difficult it is to change a military plan if the forces are to be sustained. And ultimately the decision to proceed with operations in the Eastern Mediterranean was taken at a time when, as far as I was concerned, a good deal of our logistic planning had been put on hold or reversed, to the extent that it was negated. There are three things which particularly come to mind, I think, worth recording. One is that we had, through the particular endeavours of the captain of HMS Albion, three strike carriers available for the operations: Eagle, Bulwark and Albion. Albion had not been expected to be ready, but was ready in time. But we only had one ammunition ship which could replenish at sea. So when I hear of forces being made leaner and meaner, or front line first, I'm always a bit anxious as to how this desirable objective has been achieved. Is it by cutting the support services to the extent where the front line, in fact, begins to become impotent? So we come then to the second point of this, because the hospital arrangements, the medical arrangements, were dependent on a new troop ship which was being got ready for service. At the time the operation was ordered, she was in the South Atlantic. I say she was off the Cape of Good Hope, but you get the impression that she was well away from the Mediterranean. Two other troop ships were going to bring reinforcements to the Mediterranean and indeed to our operation, and then were to convert to hospital ships as auxiliaries. And thirdly, we had two light fleet carriers which were going to be carrying helicopters and assault troops. And when they had landed their assault troops, the helicopters and they would then become a part of our hospital arrangements as casualty clearing stations. And they had medical equipment provided on board, boxed and ready for them to deploy in their hangars as soon as the troops had been landed. Well, when these two ships came through Malta on their way to the Eastern Mediterranean, I happened to be there, being left behind by the main force when they flew to Cyprus. And I found that their medical arrangements had been boxed away, that they'd been told they weren't required. And the surgeon captain, who was supposed to be in charge of all these operations, had been told to go on leave, so he wasn't there either. And the two troop ships, incidentally, were still in the UK. So there we were, about to embark on an operation, and our hospital arrangements were reliant on these two carriers reactivating their medical arrangements in time to be made ready. And thirdly, the accidents of life have to be catered for, and I had been told that I could be only allocated one naval storeship. She was the RFA Fort Duquesne. And I said, I really don't think it's safe to rely on one supply ship of that sort. We must have another one. So after much pleading, I had the resources of half the Fort Dunvegan made available. And on the day, the RFA Fort Duquesne had lost her propeller at Gibraltar. So she wasn't available at all. And so my resources consisted of half the Fort Dunvegan when she could be made available. And from this, you'll appreciate that it was very difficult logistically. One thing we were not badly placed for was we had some fine new fleet tankers capable of replenishment at sea. And that was useful. Except the names had not been very cleverly chosen, so that you had Tide Race, Tide Reach, and Tide Range, all of which were capable of getting muddled up, if not in signals, at least in one's head. And a ship called the Ulna, which I think, I believe I'm right in saying, is still in service now. Could it be 30? Yeah, might be. There's one other thing which I'm just raking my memory to bring forward on this particular side. Yes. It is surprising how quickly people forget the pattern of life in active operations. After we'd been in the Eastern Mediterranean for a few days, I got reports of people being short of cocoa. And of course, because we were limited in our naval stores and fitling stores, replenishment, this was not going to be easy to do anything about. And I thought, why are we short of cocoa? Observing that ships were told to store to capacity, if necessary, every day while they were in Malta. Normally, you're not allowed to do that, but the commander chief gave a direction. Ships were to store to capacity all the time, keep themselves topped up. And of course, the answer is quite simple. In peacetime, cocoa is required for only a few watchkeepers on the bridge and in the engine room. In wartime, both watches will want to have cocoa during their time on board, whether you're at action stations or defence stations, which means half the ship's company at a time. But there's a big demand for cocoa. And so 3 months' supply of cocoa is quite a lot of cocoa. And people had been emptying their storerooms since 1945 of this excess quantity of cocoa because they weren't using it. And they didn't think that they got to go back to that standard of cocoa stores as opposed to the peacetime for the officer watch and the quartermaster. And that's just one little sideline. So eventually we flew out to Malta and to Cyprus on several occasions during the period from the end of July through August and September and into October. And we were in fact busy in planning in Malta, I think, when the final crunch came and it was the politicians decided that they would take military action. It's not for me to comment on the quality of confidentiality, but it was reached the ridiculous when the chief of staff was rung up in Malta by somebody in London, possibly dare one mention First Sea Lord, saying that this information was so secret it was not even to be told to the commander-in-chief. Which, of course, the chief of staff immediately ignored that ridiculous instruction. As one appreciates, the politicians were desperately keen to screen their activities. So I rejoined the force staff off Cyprus, and on the 5th of November, the parachute landing. I've got ahead of myself. The two fleet carriers, light fleet carriers, came into Malta and then they sailed off. And meantime, we had extricated some troops who were flying into Malta and got them put on board these ships so that they could land in the right place and time. And the bombers had started to go out from Malta. And I just wanted to record my sense of repulsion when I listened to the bombers going out, because one realized that this was active operations against Egypt with consequences which one could hardly predict. And the V force with these great jets, which to us were comparatively modern, big aircraft, and they had such an extremely ominous sound about them, I found the whole experience rather daunting. Although one had listened to hundreds of bombers going out during the war from the UK, coming over one's head in Normandy in 1944. But this was just a particularly ominous and reasonably, I think, one was troubled by what the consequences might be. Anyway, so we landed our parachutists on the 5th of November, and they were extremely successful, and the word was that the port side was surrendering, and that the entry into the canal was therefore clear. And so in the morning, we called alongside the motor launch. Now, this is a properly commissioned small warship. And this motor launch took on board the admiral, the general, and the air marshal, and some of their staff, including me. I had been told in advance that I would be General Stockwell's liaison officer. I'd had the happy experience of serving with him in Madagascar during the war, we had met several times casually since. If I had gone with him, I would have been wearing khaki uniform. But as my admiral was going ashore, I had to go in white uniform, as he had chosen to do. And as you'll see, this was perhaps not the best costume. And the flag lieutenant was also obviously in attendance. And so we set off, and the motor launch headed towards the entrance to the canal at port side. flying the biggest Admiral's flag I've seen for a long time. And as we passed the de Lesseps statue, just a couple hundred yards further up, we saw the Brigadier Schorn. He waved at us and we waved back vigorously. And we had also with us the French General Beauf, who was a very lively character. And we were making our way up the, or down the canal, to the Canal Company building. And when there was sound like angry wasps singing round the bridge, and it was decided to turn round and go in the opposite direction, as we were obviously being fired on. And it transpired that the Brigadier hadn't been waving at us, he'd been trying to wave the ship to turn around to go back. They hadn't got that far yet. And so we went ashore in the area, in the vicinity of the de Lesseps statue, and made our way to the brigade headquarters of this brigadier, who was Brigadier Rex Maddock, Royal Marines, where a high-powered consultation took place. And while I was there, the flag lieutenant and I had to travel in an open jeep, which in our white uniforms, and knowing that Portside was reputedly full of men armed with weapons produced by the Soviet consul, we thought we were rather conspicuous. And who should I meet but a man dressed in army battle dress with a general's insignia, and then more closely turned out to be the Commandant General of the Royal Marines, who'd quite illicitly got himself shipped over to Portside with the assault force. And there he was, carrying a rifle over his shoulder. And the last time I'd actually seen General Sir Campbell Hardy was when he was a brigade commander in Ypres in Malaya in 1951, and he was going on patrol to watch the activities of one of his commandos, commanded at that moment by Major Rex Maddock. And I'd come to call on the brigadier, and he took me with him in his jeep. And again, I was wearing white uniform, and so I was able to make a joke about the coincidence of my feeling rather conspicuous, and the only times that I was actively on active operations with him. And that's not an elaborated story, that's a true story. The Admiral and the Flag Lieutenant went back on board. I followed later, the General being happy that he could get on his own. But this is a mistake, because he subsequently entrusted himself to a landing craft assault, which was in harbour from the fleet. With the experience that I'd had of LCAs, I would have been happier if he'd gone in a more powerful boat, because sure enough, started with only one engine, finished up with no engines, and the signalling lantern didn't work very well either. And so we very nearly lost the General at sea.